Let us begin. Okay, so this is another class on our Intimate Way of Zen by James Ishmael Ford. And this is on the list. The syllabus for tonight was chapters 13, 14, and 15, but I'm really just concentrating on chapter 14. The great faith, great doubt, and great determination. I doubt we're going to run out of things to talk about. Chapter 15 was interesting too, about pride and stuff, but yes, so Ford says the Zen way has three maxims framed by the 18th century Rinzai master Hakuin Eikaku. We find each of them as part of the practice much earlier in Zen's development, but he put them together succinctly. The work of Zen calls us into great doubt, great faith, and great energy. They're critically important to the deep pursuit of our heart's quest, and each informs the other. So, in our lineage, we call this great faith, great doubt, and great determination. So Ford talks about doubt, and mentions that story from the Bible, one of the Gospels anyway, about doubting Thomas, who, Christ was crucified, born again. There he was in front of his disciples, but Thomas didn't. He didn't believe that this could really be Jesus. So he said, he asked to go up and touch his wounds from the crucifixion, and it was only when he touched Jesus's wounds that he believed. So he's that James points out that this is like it's an example of like Thomas, that doubting Thomas, that was a spiritual weakness, right? That he was not able to have the same kind of belief without evidence that the others were. But he said, in Zen, in Buddhism, we don't view belief or faith in the same way. That faith without evidence is not something that is required of us. And doubt is not a spiritual failing. But he says there are indeed forms of doubt that legitimately hinder us on the spiritual path. It's not hard to create a list. Such hindering doubts include superficial skepticism that flirts with nihilism, a hesitance, an inability to get in gear and get on with it, a lack of trust in the possibility some teacher or teaching might actually have something important for us and might actually be able to guide us. All of these are problematic, but doubt itself, that feeling of uncertainty, can offer rich possibilities on the spiritual path. For instance, we can reframe that gospel story to make Thomas someone who must know for himself and is thrown body and soul into the project. All of a sudden, Thomas becomes a figure who could fit into a Zen koan. In fact, bringing one's whole being to the project, including one's hesitations and uncertainties, is critical to koan practice. Zen practice suggests that doubt is actually key to our success. Of course, it requires discernment. There is an art of making doubt a spiritual tool. It requires navigating away from those doubts that are unhealthy or at least unproductive and toward doubt as the great engine of our spiritual lives. Is God real? What is truth? Who am I? Does life have meaning or is it meaningless? How do I know God? Each of these questions is, in fact, a seed of doubt. And I think it fair to say these questions are different from run-of-the-mill doubt, the half-hearted thing that prevents our throwing ourselves into some project. They are aspects of the burning questions of our humanity and are precisely what our spiritual life needs. Given attention, taken on as a spiritual practice, any of these questions can become Zen's great doubt. So, before I get into my next section here, I forgot to get pens and papers because, you know, in the hallway there, box of pen and pads of paper. And those of you at home, I'm guessing, have something like that nearby. I'm just going to give you a few moments to reflect. And I don't know about you, but I always find it easier to have something to just jot down my ideas. I'll wait for Junri to get back before going on to the next part.
Romeo, is he a practicing minister, like the Universals, or does he do mostly Buddhism, or does he both?
Both. He's semi-retired now. This is about the author of the book. Frankly, like, you can make a better living as a Unitarian minister than you can as a Zen teacher. So,
not saying much.
Yeah.
So he did that, but he also, yeah, he also always had students and did Zen retreats and all that kind of stuff. All right, so we are passing out pads of paper and pens. Everything is settled down. All right, so I want to talk about the word doubt because I looked up doubt, the definitions of doubt, and I was surprised at how negative they sounded. So one definition was a lack of confidence or distrust. Like, it has doubts about his abilities. An inclination not to believe or accept, a claim met with doubt. Uncertainty of belief or opinion that often interferes with decision-making. Or deliberate suspension of judgment. A state of affairs giving rise to uncertainty, hesitation, or suspense. The outcome is still in doubt, example. So I just, out of curiosity, I looked up the word wonder. And here's some definitions of wonder. A cause of astonishment or admiration, a marvel. A quality of exciting, amazed admiration. Rapt attention or astonishment at something awesomely mysterious or new to one's experience. Or a feeling of doubt or uncertainty. So, in my experience, sometimes the kinds of doubts that the kind of this, my teachers would say all doubts are ultimately one. All these spiritual doubts can end up being, eventually they kind of come together in a doubt mass. One doubt mass, which doesn't even really have necessarily words to it. But many kinds of doubts can fuel our spiritual practice, can provide that kind of motivation and curiosity. And some of them are have the feeling of doubt, and it can even be a painful or disorienting doubt. But I think it doesn't have to have a negative connotation either. We can have questions, curiosity, that I feel has more of that quality of wonder, which also can be driving our practice. So what I wanted to do was invite you to reflect going to ask a few questions and brainstorm topics of wonder and doubt that are real for you that you experience. And then once we have those, I will write them a shared document for us, just so we can kind of I always mean to pull these things up beforehand, but I always forget. I sit in back chatting and eating cupcakes. Okay. So when it comes time, I will share screen and type up what people are willing to share. But in the meantime, I'll kind of lead you through this little meditation. So invite your spiritual or existential doubts to arise in your body mind. What aspects of your existence remain a mystery to you? Think of things you have been taught by your culture, by society, by your family of origin, by your religious upbringing, that you seriously doubt. And I'll give some space after I read this for you to reflect. What do you yearn to understand? Not simply out of curiosity, but because such understanding would help bring you peace of mind. What have you encountered in your life or in the teachings that beckon you to explore the limits of what you know? The great mystery may be beyond description, but our individual life meets that mystery in particular ways. What doubts, questions, edges, places of wonder, or passionate curiosity arise for you in a way that feels very relevant to you personally? Sure, that's something we could all contemplate for quite a while.
Could you give us those again, please?
What aspects of your existence remain a mystery to you? Think of things you have been taught by your culture, by society, by your family of origin, by your religious upbringing, that you seriously doubt. What do you yearn to understand? Not simply out of curiosity, but because such understanding would help bring you peace of mind. What have you encountered in your life or in the teachings that beckons you to explore the limits of what you know? What doubts, questions, edges, places of wonder, or passionate curiosity arise for you in a way that feels very relevant to you personally? I mean, you don't have to think of all of them, just, you know, hoping to just get something flowing. So I'm hoping that people will be willing to share a little bit. Don't have edit access. That's weird.
Make a copy of this.
Looks like I'm not signed in at all. Somehow Brightways and Sangha got signed out, and I hope ideally it doesn't never get signed out, but it did get signed out. So
You can just open a notepad or something or WordPad, put it in there if you want.
yeah, who knows where that is.
It's in the search bar. Type in the search bar too. WordPad.
Okay. So, topics of doubt and wonder.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I have three, but I will start with one. This is serious to me. I want to know what happens to me when I'm anesthetized.
Don't know how to pronounce.
AI. ESTHE, and that's the E, ETISED.
Anesthetized. There's a T in there somewhere.
Well, let word pick it up, and then we'll correct it. I mean, that's for
Okay.
those who can't type too. Hey, it took it.
Let's see. Rachel.
I also have three, but I'll also just pick one. And it's a question, actually, and I want to ask, why is compassion and love discriminated when called to love and be compassionate to everyone?
Discriminated by who?
Just ran by anyone. Like, if we're called to love and be compassionate to everyone, why don't we? You know what I mean?
Did you have one, Isaac?
And right wing on, but so for me, like the big one is, will I ever resolve the conditions of my PTSD?
Shoketsu.
I wonder at the diversity and immensity of humankind, all the different languages and religions and cultures, many of which are coming over here and I'm becoming acquainted with, it just blows my mind. It's amazing.
Leah?
I would love to be sure, if I could, and to know that my being here matters, that my existence makes a difference or has made a difference. And I made a note. The perfect example of this is a movie, It's a Wonderful Life. And in it, an angel shows him what the world would look like without him. And I don't have that option because I don't live in a movie. I would like to.
Thank you. Percy.
I'm very passionate about the genealogy of my family. My mother didn't know her birth mother. And I always wonder if I'm ever going to find out with certainty who she was. I haven't been able to.
So that would be your birth grandmother that you don't. Judith?
Who slash what created this place, and why are we humans here specifically?
Question.
We seem specifically here, specifically. We seem so unprepared for the situation.
Andrew?
For the longest time, doubted and questioned the existence of a soul. A soul that survives death.
Erica?
I wonder why life isn't better.
Better?
Fair.
Fair. Fair.
Fair.
That's why the Buddhists created the whole six realms of existence to try to explain that one. Jen.
I'm constantly wondering what should we do with memories.
So, when we are discriminating the kinds of doubts, or just not discriminating, discerning the kinds of doubts that can fuel our spiritual practice, it often requires us to take these kinds of things that we wonder about and look into them, I guess make them personally relevant and home in on a question that we can answer. My example was there's a ceremony called Shosan where the teacher stands up in front of the room and people can come up and ask questions. And you stand and you ask your question very briefly, and there's a brief back and forth. And it was always so cute when Gyokuko, my teacher, would do that with the kids in Dharma school. So she'd stand up there very seriously in her robes, and they would come up, and they would totally just ask all kinds of questions, like, well, why are kids mean, or you know, fun stuff like that. And just, you know, one of them would be like, and usually, you know, the little ones, they'd have to have their parents and bring them up and be like, is there life on other planets? You know, you'd have to have, she would answer in this really compassionate, but, you know, way, but you're like, I don't know. But, you know, because obviously some of this stuff is just unanswerable. But if we have a particular resonance with a question, there's usually something within it that we can explore and resolve. And in some ways it helps to ask, like, what is it? Why do I care so much about this question? You know, what is it that I hope to resolve or know within this question? And some of it's just, you know, leaning into it directly. Like, my question right now is, how do you know you're being authentic? You know, who are you really? But if we're empty of inherent self nature, what kind of thing are we looking within to find and know that I'm being authentic? Like, what? And I do, you know, and I don't mean it in like really a psychological way, but just, it's so easy. Whatever we do and say can feel a little bit off, like it's not quite the way we meant to present, or like it says on the precepts, to speak, you know, not one word is to keep this precept, because like the second you speak, it's not right. So that's the kind of, you know, question that I feel can really inspire us to sit, you know, like psychological karmic conditions, you know, how does that relate to who we are? How do we have any influence over that? Are we just a victim of these things? Where does, you know, personal choice and effort come in? You know, being sure that our being matters has made a difference. You know, what is the measure of a human life? A really deep level. Does somebody have to have made an impact? Can a life be, have inherent worth? And what is that? Why is life not fair? Why, you know, what is worthwhile about life, even if it isn't fair? So that is great doubt. Something that keeps us seeking, but then we have great faith and determination as well. So very briefly here, so the necessity of faith. So James Ford says, early on in my practice, I asked the question, how much faith do I have to have to do this? I asked it of the late British-born Soto Zen priest Ho Unjiu Kennett, who at the time was fresh to North America after 5 years in Japan and had just opened a small temple in San Francisco. It was a real question. To be honest, I didn't have a lot of faith. I had a lot of trouble with any assertions about reality that moved too much from the observable, the measurable, the quantifiable. She was a large woman with a quick smile and eyes that cut right into the center of my being. She smiled, she looked, and she replied, "All you need to believe is that maybe, possibly, you could learn something." And that was my mustard seed, that tiniest of things. As it turns out, she was right. So he has a really interesting, the differentiation between belief and faith. Since I want to suggest as a working definition that belief be used for those things that are asserted as true by someone in authority. We read it, we were told it, we simply accept it. So there are plenty of religious traditions where that's essentially where it ends, right? Like, and actually the measure of your spiritual practice is how strong your belief can be without evidence. But he's saying that the way we use, if we just to use a different term, the faith, said it is the dynamic of our lives wherein we accept some guidance, maybe that little bit of belief that I can learn something, then do it, then reflect on that doing. Or maybe we find that, nope, it wasn't true, at least not for me. Or yes, there is something here, at least for me. And then going at it again from this deeper or more mature perspective, the process of faith is ongoing. So we talk about entrusting ourselves to something, like taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is entrusting yourself to it. Letting go of our pride, cynicism, fearfulness, skeptical doubt. Building trust a little at a time, being willing to make mistakes and be seen making mistakes. So, I mean, I really delved into Zen as wholeheartedly as I knew how, but I also was at critical moments skeptical. So I wrote this poem to myself way back when, because I was rational, right? I'm trained as a scientist and I'm not going to believe that bullshit. And like, I don't believe in God or any of those things that I'd have no evidence for myself. And so I really thought I was superior to other kinds of religious and spiritual people by being a Buddhist, because I'm not accepting all of that, you know, stuff. It's only what you can verify for yourself. And then at some point, you know, when I'm like, I don't know, I was in Tassajara Monastery for a practice period and, you know, sitting meditation for hours and hours a day. And I recognized, you know, I don't really know any of this for myself yet. I'm just taking these people's word for it that this is true and this is good and this is going to be worthwhile. And I momentarily was really panicked. Like, maybe I really am in a cult. I thought I was so smart, but I'm like, oh no. I was going on a lot of belief. But I love how James Ford, he pointed out, like, we have to operate on belief. We don't have time to investigate everything for ourselves. We have a belief that it's safe to drive our car to the grocery store, right? A belief that the car works. You know, it's just, we don't.
The plane's not going to go down when you're in it.
That's what I'm saying.
I mean, we just, you know, you got to just, you know, believe that things are the way they are. But yeah, so I wrote this poem to myself, to my skeptical self. You say, I cannot have faith until I have proof. But you will never find the proof until you have faith. Question anything of real importance, God, enlightenment, magic, the fundamental goodness of the human heart, and the incontestable evidence is invisible to the skeptic. You say, then this evidence is merely delusion conjured up by wishful thinking. But those who have proven it to themselves know this is not the case. They dance with exuberance, free from doubt. you say. They're dancing because they have put blinders on and ignore the dismal and dreary truth. But while they are dancing, what are you doing? So, Ford says, when faith is not the opposite of doubt, it becomes the companion of doubt. So you can get more comfortable having a little bit of faith over time. You do verify things for yourself. You know, it's a little at a time. And then let's see. Great determination, great energy, or great determination. Ford has to say about that. Great energy is our individual determination and effort as a generative element, a spark that flies within our lives. What we, you, I actually do or not do is critically important. One commentator on these three aspects of practice suggests that the word I'm translating as energy could also be translated as wrath. There is much to dig into with that phrasing. I could just as easily say it requires great desire, passion, determination, energy. The Zen teacher Ko-un Yamada tells us great determination is a strong resolve that wells up from the bottom of our gut and spurs us on. Sometimes it is doggedness, just putting our shoulder to the wheel, getting up each morning and turning our heart and mind to the project. Much of the Zen way is about taking our own initiative. We put ourselves on the cushion. We turn our mind toward the matter of intimacy. Great determination to find the ox, answer our spiritual questions, personally taste that which is greater, be at peace, takes different, you know, forms for each of us, be awake for our life, and even over time, kind of what it is that inspires us the most may change. And then these three, which we say it's kind of like a stool with three legs. So strong and even painful doubt, plus just a reasonable measure of faith, can result in strong determination. It's like, it may feel kind of miserable to be tormented by doubts, but from the point of view of practice, it's a good thing. I mean, as long as you don't feel debilitated by it. But if it's not that skeptical doubt, it's a real curiosity that can really spur us forward. Strong faith and just a reasonable amount of doubt can also result in strong determination, right? If you're just like, you know, I'm just going to commit myself to this practice, and you know, I'm not really sure where it's going, but that can also result in great practice. And I think strong determination and strong faith, even if you don't really have strong doubt, I think if you really were determined, like the doubt would come, right? Like this practice leads you toward opening the mind. So I guess I'll leave it there. We have a few minutes left to chat and discuss. Anybody has questions, comments? I don't know who's first.
It's real short.
Like a tie.
It's real short.
My name is Steve. Yeah, go ahead.
My short. I may have missed this, but are you saying, or is the author saying, that doubt is an important ingredient on our path?
Yes.
Who, you or the author?
Me and the author and the Zen master and the Zen ancestors.
And God.
I only said, and God. But like I said, I'm doubt or wonder or kind of curiosity, but not idle curiosity, right? Kind of passionate curiosity would be another way to put it. And doubt, doubt is also a hindrance, but that is doubt about ourselves and about the path. So that is not helpful, that kind of doubt.
I was what you just said was kind of one of my thoughts. It seems to me that most people come to practice specifically because of doubt. I mean, you hear many stories, you know, when people hear what's it called when a student tells their story?
Way-seeking mind.
You always, I mean, doubt is almost always a part of those stories.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I think maybe it's just suffering. But
I guess I'm seeing doubt as a form of suffering.
Well, what I would think is, I don't know. I guess when I just picture myself coming to practice and feeling really dissatisfied with life in general and all the ways that I could see my life unfolding, I mean, I guess that, yeah, I don't, I can't parse it out. I think it's just different ways to slice the tomato. You got suffering, you got that, but very closely related is something that I've talked about before, where the samvega is a term for that sense of like passionate dissatisfaction. It was like, you know, that would basically look around like, this is bullshit. That life does not have to be this way. We just become convinced that there's got to be a better way. But then samvega is paired with pasada, which is kind of a faith or a determination. So this is just kind of, you could break it into two instead of three, I guess. but because then at some way you have to kind of stubbornly go, damn it, I'm going to find a different way. I'm going to keep on looking because, you know, whatever's being presented to me is just not, does not suffice. And that could take a lot of courage when you're just, you know, surrounded by people like I was, lovely people, right? But when I'm a teenager and I'm asking, you know, does life have any meaning? Everybody's just looking at me like, you know, like I was just silly. And it took me a long time. It took me till I found Buddhists in my 20s. But other people were like, yeah, I wonder. Erica.
When I even asked when I was a teenager, people would say, are you depressed? Mm-hmm. Like they thought it was like, but it can't possibly just be an existential question.
You know, yeah. Yeah. I don't know if people just didn't have that.
Yeah.
Some people just don't have that question.
Yeah.
Or they do and they don't want to face
it. No, I don't think they're conscious of it. I really don't. I think some people start to get aware that something strange is going on. Yeah. And then other people buy into it and wear pink and lipstick.
I understand where Erica is coming from, but I can't help but think of my mother, who had very deep Christian faith, which gave her life meaning. I mean, there was no doubt in her mind that life had very deep and important meaning. And so to say that, not that I'm taking offense or anything, but to say that she was not thinking, she thought about it a lot as she read her Bible and as she went to church.
I have a lot of respect for that.
Do you feel like she was exploring it and trying to deepen it? I mean, what I can imagine is it's a Christian who has, unshakable faith that there is God and that, there is heaven and all of this, but also still wanting like a closer relationship with God, more of a sense of it, or wanting to surrender more to it. Like there could still be a sense of kind of inquiry and growth.
I don't know what she thought of heaven. I'm not even sure she believed in that. She, who knows about that would probably be her response. But I do know that she truly believed that this is kind of made me tearful because I remember her saying this, that there are times in your life when Jesus is your only friend. And I know that she experienced that. I know exactly what she was experiencing. And my mother was incredibly well read, incredibly bright. She was an artist and quite talented. So, this is not your woman on the street. This is somebody's put some thought into this.
Well, I mean, in the next, I think it was.
And she would say, excuse me, that if I had raised that question, which I didn't, but if I had raised the question you did, then we probably need to go see a doctor and talk about this. Or go to the minister is probably what, let's go to the minister and talk about this.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, different paths for different folks, right? Because like, the a path that can provide such satisfaction to one person, just like, that doesn't. And it's interesting that in this chapter, like Ford does talk about the other path of devotion, when he's talking about faith. And many of you might be familiar with this, but so there's many different kinds of Buddhism in Japan, but two of the biggest were Zen, and biggest because they appealed to common people, not just to like erudite monks. And that was Zen and Pure Land Buddhism. So in Zen, we have this very much like, self-power. They call it Jogiki. And it's, you're going to meditate and you're going to study and you're going to, work on yourself. And then I can't remember the Japanese for it, but other power is the Pure Land where you cultivate devotion for Amida Buddha. And we're in an age where, like a degenerate age, where like none of us are really cut out for enlightenment, which, as he said, points out, like if you're really honest with yourself, you gotta wonder, right? Like, I don't know. If I examined my mind, like I don't know. So he says, but they believe that if you cultivate this really deep faith, you'll be reborn in this Western paradise that Amida Buddha has set up, where then it's easy to get enlightened. So then you don't stay in that heaven forever. You do get enlightened. That is the goal, but you need some help. But if you really look at the practice, it can be a very deep practice. Right, of chanting the name of Amida Buddha, of cultivating that complete devotion can be another, in a way, another kind of meditation, another challenge to the self, another form of letting go. And in Japan, they have a saying, I don't know exactly know who has the saying, but there is a saying that practice is like a tunnel with two, like a tunnel. And if you go in by self power, you have to come out by other power. If you go in by other power, you have to come out by self power.
That's interesting.
So it's kind of like sends a chill down my spine. I'm kind of like, oh shit. Like if you're a self power person, like kind of like, God, what would that mean? But it also kind of points to like this is This is bigger than our own little self-improvement project, right? But then if you are going in by that other power, and if it's all just projected out there and somebody else is going to take care of it, and you don't make it something internal, then you also aren't going to complete your practice in the same way. Yoli.
So I practiced Shin Buddhism when I was in Reno just for about a year. So I visited a center here. And I remember after it was very churchy. So he would talk to us from a pulpit. We would sing hymns while standing up. And then afterwards, we would go downstairs for tea or whatever and another class. And I remember one of the guys at my table saying, because we're talking about the Amida Buddha and how, you know, everybody would be enlightened at one time. And he sat back and said, so I don't have to do anything then.
That's very cool.
And that's exactly what he said. He's like, I don't have to do anything. Somebody else is going to do it for me. I thought that was a very interesting take on all of that.
Which, if there was a really good, like, Shin minister around, would be like, yes, you do.
sitting at our table.
Actually, yeah, moment. like cultivating that kind of devotion and purity of heart is hard work. Andrew.
The other comment that I was going to make, when you it just kind of came up as you asked a question about how do I know if I'm authentic or something like that, and it occurred to me that what if authenticity is an appropriate response to changing conditions?
Yeah, well,
because
I mean,
once you lock in, like, this is because then you, because once you say this is authenticity, and this way, then you've kind of frozen it. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
It makes sense. You know, when I stand back and I go, that's probably true. And in this moment, how do I know this is authentic?
Okay.
Which is like not something you can just like, oh, well, on Tuesday I found out. You know, like it's not the kind of thing you can just, you know, answer once and for all. But it's like, what is the nature of the self? What is real? Can you respond from the ground of reality, not from the relative, but from the space of emptiness? What comes out of emptiness? What is my expression of emptiness?
So you're saying that you have never had a moment when you have really felt completely without anything negative, just at peace, not under meditation, just.
No, I'm not saying that.
Well, to me, that's authenticity.
Well, I'm not expressing fully then what I mean. All right. I'll leave it at that. Dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna,
they fixed up the.